Sloth, again, a very interesting conception in the Middle Ages. You know, generally, we think about that. Well, I sort of tell my students the sort of classic example is one of the great differences between Cook and Herzman is that I like early morning classes. He loathes early morning classes. Well, I have my 8:30. There are a lot of students who tend to sort of side with him on this one and show up, if at all, a little bit later. You kind of look upon that as the textbook sin, you know, the sloth, the alarm clock comes, and you take your mallet, and you go, bam, okay, I'm not getting up this morning. In fact, it was a much more widespread idea in the Middle Ages. Sloth was essentially any activity that was directed against what you ought to be doing at the time. Right? If you see the good and know what it is and don't do it or do it slowly, you're guilty of the sin of sloth. Again, very interesting to think about some ramifications of that. One of the things that I can remember from my graduate school days was that I used to try and think of things to do instead of writing my dissertation. Okay, so that I would get up in the morning and I would say, well, I have to write a dissertation today. I have to sit down at my desk and I have to do X amount of pages today to keep to my schedule. But I can't do that because the bathroom is dirty. I better go clean the bathroom first. Now, I got through the previous 4 years of graduate school without cleaning my bathroom, but all of a sudden that seemed like an urgent thing to do. Now, somebody who would have walked in, looked at that, had a mild heart attack at seeing me sort of scrub out the bathtub, would have thought what a virtuous person he had turned into. In fact, I was being guilty of, in a textbook example, the sin of sloth, because what I was doing was something that was different from what I ought to be doing. Okay? And then, interestingly enough, the next two sins turn out to be...
Or the next three sins.
The next three sins. I'm sorry,
we got to count to seven here.
We're not in math.
We then have avarice, and really it's again the avarice and prodigality, and then gluttony, and then lust.
I think actually we missed the anger is what we did.
Anger.
And I'm getting all angry when I think about that.
It's 3, 1, and 3, basically.
Yeah. And notice also, the point that I wanted to get to at the top is that the last sin that we deal with is lust, which is, of course, the first thing that we dealt with in the Inferno. That turns out to be the least serious in both cases, but it's the last thing that the souls, and in particular the soul of Dante, who makes the journey, needs to be purged of. Very interesting, in other words, to see the way in which it turns out to be the same, a similar system, but in reverse to a certain extent. Now, in all of these cases, what one is getting at is a root tendency toward the sin, and what the pilgrim has to do, which turns out to be mighty like what the souls themselves have to do, is cure themselves of this tendency by a turning and a purgation of the will, and the faculty of choice. Dante, the pilgrim, needed to learn about the nature of sin in the Inferno, and that was primarily a matter of the intellect. Why do people sin? What makes it so attractive? And, of course, ultimately, how can I avoid doing it? But in purgatory, it's much more a question of will and choice. And I think here, too, that division is something that Dante gets from Augustine's Confessions, who divides his own spiritual journey between knowing the truth, finding the truth, an intellectual search for the truth, and then being able to make the choice with his own will. And it turns out that even though, for Augustine, that journey is intertwined, it's not identical. Okay?
And therefore, one of the great moments of the purgatory is right in the middle of the purgatorio, which of course is therefore right in the middle of the entire commedia, if you will, counting all the cantos together, sort of cantos 50 and 51, the real center of the whole thing, is a discussion, an extended discussion, of free will. Because although there are many theological issues, including some of the most arcane, that Dante will take up in various parts of the Commedia, none is more important, perhaps none is as important as free will. Do people really have freedom of the will? Do they really have choices that they make? Or are, in fact, our wills so impeded that we make no choices on our own? If the latter is true, then much of what Dante said about responsibility doesn't make much sense. If you have no control, you don't really have the responsibility, and the whole system becomes, in a sense, sort of intellectually indefensible. But Dante is very much rooted in the principle that however much we may be damaged,